Okay. I don't know. You press. It's good. We're good. Here we go. We are now at one of Israel's major junctures, right in the beginning of its early years. We have what's called the Sinai Campaign, or Mitzvah Kadesh. What happened is as follows. We were talking before that the Moshe Dayan created this Unit 101 to do reprisal raids against all the Dayan terrorist activities across the border. Let's talk about that. Ariel Sharon was brought in to run this unit. After a while, it got disbanded and sort of became like a Seiret at Sanchanim, which then became Seiret Matkal and things like that. Yeah.
Was Ariel Sharon Jewish?
100%, yeah.
Really? I heard he wasn't.
Why?
No idea.
No, he was Jewish.
Is there another prime minister who wasn't Jewish?
No. As far as I know, they're all Jewish. And then I go do deep checks, you know, on their family, but it's...
Might have heard the same thing as in Michael.
Really?
Yeah.
As far as I know, there's no question about the Jewishness of these people. But, like I said, I don't know.
They could be not Jewish.
I think they're Jewish.
No, I'm saying a prime minister could be not Jewish.
Oh, could a prime minister be not Jewish? Yeah. If you get... There's non-Jewish Knesset members. Right? You have Arab Knesset members that are not Jewish. And if they have enough votes, they can become prime minister. That was Mayor Kahana's complaint with the Israeli, you know, with the state of Israel. He said, based on your constitution, you keep calling it a Jewish democratic state. And he says, make up your mind. Either you're Jewish or you're democratic. Because if you're democratic, well, if the Arabs get enough votes, they can put a prime minister, you know, in office. And you can change all the laws that you made. So make up your mind. Do you want to be a Jewish state or are you going to be a democratic state? That's what he, you know, would always argue.
What's the response?
I don't know if there was a good response. It was more like, it won't happen and things like that, you know.
How do we say Jewish democratic?
So I guess what they mean when they write that is, you know, Jewish values, all these Jewish symbols we spoke about in the last class, the national anthem and all of these things are like Jewish. Now, if you look at the leftist literature, they would want to make everything more universal and not just Jewish, right? And why should there be a moment like you have now? You have I found it very disgraceful, but there were people that said the same way that there's like a day, a memorial day for the fallen soldiers. So in Tel Aviv, they had like also like a memorial day for all the, I don't know, terrorists that were killed, something like that. All right, so so you have something like that. So you have left-wing people like that. Usually the most left-wing people are the Jews, like, you know, they're bending over backwards to be human beings as opposed to Jews. Shlomo Carbach, when he first started his career going out to universities, see, he said very simply, go on campus, how would he find which Jews to be Makariv? No one's walking around with big yarmulkes in their head. How would he find? He'd walk over and say, what religion are you? Said, you know, a person would say, I'm a Muslim. He said, okay, I'm a Christian. Like I said, I'm a human being. He said, oh, Shalom Aleichem. So that was what, you know, that's how the Jew would answer. Okay. Anyway, getting back to this. What do we have? We now have lots of terrorist raids. Fine. And the reprisal isn't, it's helping a little bit, but not enough. But then you have a major event that occurs. Now, earlier, 1869, a private French firm built the Suez Canal. I would try to explain a whole bunch of people that when we crossed, at least, you know, what some people say, crossed the Sinai, we didn't necessarily have to cross the Sinai. Okay, if you look at the map, there was lots and lots of land area that you could easily go from Egypt into Israel without going across any body of water. What happened was, 1869, this private French firm built the Suez Canal. Now, you cannot get across it. The whole idea was to, it was a 100-mile waterway connecting the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. Previously, you had to go all around Africa to bring your goods. Now you're able to shoot right through what's called the Cape of Good Hope, and it was a tremendously strategic location. Okay, now, This is a French company together with British. The British sort of took control of the area together with the French. And they were, Egypt was in a little bit of upheaval. It helped the British get like a foothold in England. And they said, French and British together, come and build this. Comes 1956, and who's the president of Egypt at this time?
Nasser.
Nasser decides to nationalize...
Who's this guy?
That's Edwin.
Money.
Oh, Nasser. Okay. I just was curious. Jamal Abdel Nasser is the president of Egypt.
Is that like a known, like everyone knows this?
No. Yeah.
And well, like, no one knows this. No one knows this. How do you know this? Josh, you know this?
Yeah, it's like
we're
in social
studies.
People know this?
Yes. And if you would have read the Jewish literacy that I asked you to read, you would have seen it as well.
This past week?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Really? It was one of the questions that I asked today. Anyway, Jamal Abdel Nasser is the president of Israel. Now, he...
You said
it.
Okay.
Egypt. I mean, I said Egypt. What? Now, he decides to nationalize the Suez Canal. Now, he didn't build it, but he says, all right, great, I'm going to set up a little toll booth, and any ship that wants to come through has to pay a tax, right? This is what he decides. Now, the French and the British are not happy at all. They built the whole thing, right? But he decides, my land, my rules, and I'm making this tax. Okay. So now what happens? When they make this, they decide also to block all shipping for Israel. Israel now can't get their ships in. So this is also important. So Israel's ships are blocked. Other people have to pay a tax. Israel's got all of these raids. So the army goes to Ben-Gurion and says, it's not enough to have Unit 101 do these tiny little raids. We need to go after Egypt and teach them a lesson. Ben-Gurion, this is earlier... You know, the state of Israel is all 8 years old, sort of like a baby. And he says, we can't go against the powerful Egyptian army all by ourselves. What we need to do is have two superpowers on our side. So they go and they realize that the French and the British also have a gripe against Egypt. Let's get them in, and they become a tripart army that's going and have a whole plan. Now, France, this is what we should keep in mind, at this point is Israel's chief supplier of arms. Up until 1967, they are Israel's chief supplier of arms. They're not getting from anywhere else. Soviet Union is arming everybody, all the Arab states. Israel's getting very little. They get basically nothing from America. Soon it'll start coming, but at this point, not yet. And France, they have a relationship with France. In fact, Shimon Peres, who later on in his life, becomes, you know, a big dove. And you know what I mean when I say dove or hawk? What's the between a dove and a hawk? Politics, what I'm talking about?
Peacemaker.
As a hawk, you know, right wing. And so Shimon Peres, he is instrumental in forming this alliance, and which will eventually lead to, if we don't get to it today, we'll get to it tomorrow, starting to build a nuclear reactor. Okay? It was first... The people that helped us, the country that helped us was France. Started getting us, you know, starting us building a nuclear reactor. This is all done by Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres had like an amazing life. He lived this long life, and he was sort of involved in every major thing that was going on in Israel from its infancy till recently when he passed away, you know, after being a president. Yeah. So he basically held every position in this country. It's a really remarkable person. And everybody, depending on, doesn't matter which, you know, spectrum you're on, can point to things they liked about him and things they disliked about him, because he switched in his life. He moved over from being like hawkish to dovish and all sorts of different things in between. But like I said, he was certainly involved in so many things. Now, Ben-Gurion says we can't do it ourselves, and they come up with a plan. Israel's going to go on a raid into the Sinai. They're going to come close, and here's what happens. They send in troops, okay, led by Ariel Sharon, who we mentioned before, and Rafi Eitan, who would also go on to be a famous person in Israel. He would go on to be the chief of staff. He went on later on to be in the Knesset. Raful was one of the most amazing warriors in Israel. Rabina tells some crazy story that I didn't hear of, but supposedly he was in the midst of some crazy battle and he couldn't, and he had terrible shilshal. So he just took like the knife on his bayonet, ripped open like his pants, and maintained in his squatting position, shooting, and relieving himself at the same time because he had a terrible stomach, but it wouldn't stop him from fighting. So Rabina tells the story. I don't know which book he read it in, but okay. One story that I did read about him, when he became, let's say, like a general, he still wanted to be involved in every single commando raid. And there was no way they were going to let him go on a commando raid. Can you imagine the leverage any country would have if a general fell into their hands? They weren't taking a general on a commando raid. But he's like one of these adventure people that like, oh, I want to be in on that, you know? So let's say Seret Makal, Shantet Shlosh Esrei, they're planning some crazy raid. So Raful, like, who's like chief of staff, then goes, all right, tell me when I'm going to, and they would say like, oh, meet us 0400 hours. And he come to the airfield and go, where's it? He goes, what do you mean they left 2 hours ago? Like they would tell him the wrong time. Like, we're not taking you with us, right? But he was a general. So they would just tell him the wrong information. Anyway, the two of them lead the raid. They're going through the Sinai to, on their way to the Suez Canal. Ariel Sharon, Rafael Eitan, leading infantry through the Sinai. When they, now, during this time, Egypt gets some information, but they think it's another reprisal. They think it's like Unit 101. They don't think it's an all-out war. So it took about 24 hours for them to get their act together. Yeah.
What's Israel's goal right now? Why are they leaving again?
Okay, we're going to see what happens. Okay. They want to teach Egypt a lesson for closing the Suez Canal to them and for all the Fedayeen raids. Okay, now, what the French and British is the plan. They now get there. Beforehand, Abi Ibn. Okay, we mentioned him before, Abi Ibn, who gave an amazing speech in the United Nations. He gives another one. And he talks about, in the Security Council, why Israel went to war. He explains after they're already on their way. He says, during the last 6 years, since they drew up the armistice agreement after the War of Independence, this is what's happened. He goes on to list, there have been 1,843 cases of armed robbery and theft coming from the Fedayeen across the borders. 1,339 cases of armed clash with Egyptian armed forces, 435 cases of incursion of Egyptian-controlled territory, 172 cases of sabotage perpetrated by Egyptian military units of Fedayeen in Israel. And as a result of these actions of Egyptian hostility within Israel, 364 Israelis were wounded and 101 killed. Just in 1956, 28 Israelis were killed, 127 wounded. He explains, this is why we now are retaliating. At the UN Security Council, hears it all, and they condemn Israel for the retaliation raids of Unit 101. Okay, like I said, some things don't change. So all of the initial incursions, everything they did, overlooked. Israel retaliated. Shame on you. Okay. So he gives them reason why we're going, and they go. Okay. About 100,000 soldiers were mobilized. They go in. Egypt comes, you know, goes to fight against them, and the United Nations orders everyone to stop. Security Council orders everyone to stop. France and Britain, along with them, they, now here's the plan. They say to everyone that everyone has to withdraw from where they are. Now, Egypt had gone now to the eastern side of the Suez Canal to stop the Israelis from coming towards the Suez Canal. They want to protect the Suez Canal. And they say everyone should withdraw. So Egypt, this is what France and Britain knew. Egypt said, why should we withdraw? We're the victims. They're the aggressors. And once they refused, Britain and France sent in their commandos to conquer the Suez Canal. That was the whole plan. The plan is, use Israel. This is how France and Britain use it. Use Israel to get Egypt to now not agree with the United Nations Security Council statement, giving us pretext to go and reconquer the Suez Canal. Israel goes because they want to teach Egypt a lesson and also open up the Suez Canal. So everyone has what to gain. Okay, now the British and French paratroopers land near Port Said. They drop in commandos. And then all of a sudden, British stops. All the British troops, they just ceasefire. And France is going, what are you guys doing? Now, just realize in general, France, I said to you, had a decent relationship with Israel. British never did. They still had animosity that goes back for decades under the British mandate. And all of the Irgun and Lehi and Haganah, and all the fights that were going on between British and the you know, Jews living in Israel. So it wasn't so much trust. It was more like an agreement of convenience between these countries. British stops. The British troops stopped because they were threatened. They were threatened by the Soviet Union. They were threatened by the United States. The Soviet Union threatened to use, quote, every kind of modern destructive weapon to stop them, i.e. nuke you. And the United States said, oh, you guys wanted a $1 billion loan? Well, guess that. Guess what? That's not coming. So based on these two different things, England stops. France tries to push them. Doesn't work. And basically, the war gets called off. Now, in this time, side bit of information, Ariel Sharon, which you mentioned before, as far as I'm concerned, is Jewish. He's leading a group towards the Suez Canal. Okay? He does not have permission. Ariel Sharon was famous. He'd be on his walkie-talkie saying, okay, permission to conquer the Suez Canal. And they're saying, permission denied. Right? And he's going, breaking up, can't hear you. Permission denied. Oh, that wasn't okay, right? Okay, moving on. And this is what he would do. He was famous for disregarding, and he went. And he took a group of soldiers through what's called the Mitla Pass. Okay. When I was your age, when I was Shana Aleph, and I wasn't yet into learning, and we didn't have phones, so I did a lot of reading. Okay? At night, you know, or during the break, I read. There was an author named Leon Uris, who wrote all of these historical fictions, not 1984.
No, it's George Orwell.
That's George Orwell. He wrote Exodus.
Saren had 4 or 5
No, that's not him either. Okay, Exodus.
Oh, Exodus.
Okay, Exodus, QB7.
Yes.
Okay, did you hear that? Okay, he wrote a lot of interesting books that are called historical fiction. Okay, sort of like the Herman Wouk book that I told you about before. Historical fiction is, you're dealing with real events, with real people, and you just make up a fictional character who happens to be near these people. So you do a lot of history, you know, research, you get the facts right, but there's other people that you're connected to their characters, and he builds a story. Exodus was then later made into a movie. Paul Newman starred as, you know, the Jewish guy who, for some reason, falls in love with some shiksa nurse, but okay, fine. So Paul Newman is in Exodus. Leon Uris writes this book, Exodus. He wrote QB7. He also wrote a book about the Mitla Pass, this particular case, the 1956 war. Okay? And Ariel Sharon leads them through this small, narrow place, and 38 soldiers get killed in an ambush. Right? It was a terrible strategic move. And because of that, there was sort of an unwritten, you know, rule. Unofficially, he was barred from ever becoming the chief of staff. Ariel Sharon, who later go on to be a hero in the Yom Kippur War, was barred from ever becoming the chief of staff because of this big mistake, the Mitla Pass. What's interesting was, right, Rabbi Beryl Wine points this out, that here he was, he denied being the chief of staff, but he later on becomes the Minister of Defense, which is like a higher position. Then, as Minister of Defense, and Rafael Eitan, we just mentioned, was his chief of staff. In Lebanon, there was another controversial thing that we'll get to later. He is barred, there's a whole commission, of ever being defense minister. So why does Ariel Sharon become prime minister? All right, so Rabbi Wein said, God has a strange sense of humor. Can't keep Ariel Sharon back. You know, put him here. Okay, just leapfrog. Anyway, during this time, Israel conquers Gaza. So about 100 hours. They advance as far as Sharam al-Ashek, near the Red Sea. It's a very difficult battle. 231 soldiers die, but they get all the way through the Sinai. They have tanks that come through the Sinai. They conquer the Sinai, and they get to the Suez Canal. And Ike puts his foot down. Who's Ike? Dwight D. Eisenhower. Okay, President of the United States is fuming that Israel, France, and Britain schemed to do this. Felt that diplomatically we could have worked with Egypt to open up the Suez Canal, didn't have to go to war, and is very upset that they do this, and demands that Israel withdraw. So what you had was this military success followed by a diplomatic failure. Right? And you think about it, when they first got there, Ben-Gurion says in a speech in the Knesset, okay, it's a shame that Yosef's not here because he would get very excited. Right? Ben-Gurion said, the old border with Egypt is dead. Israel is willing to start negotiating peace with Egypt immediately. Later in the speech, he praised the IDF for his glorious victory. He said, Mamad Har Sinai took place again in our times. In one of the most glorious campaigns in the history of mankind, we returned to the place where we were given the Torah, where our nation became the chosen people. Israel will retain at least some of its territorial achievements and will accept no foreign force in it or in the territories it is holding. That's what he said in the beginning. But he went back on everything. He gave back everything. He was forced into giving every single centimeter back with ostensibly nothing to show for it, but I'll get to there is some achievements. But this is what happened, like I said. You know, military victory, diplomatic failure. What did Eisenhower use to threaten Israel? First of all, he said the Soviet Union, which they were saying, was threatened to carpet bomb Israel. And Eisenhower said, and I'll let them. Would he have let them? I don't know. But it was after the elections. 56, he already was re-elected. He didn't have to curry favor with the Jews. I find it hard to believe he would let the Soviet Union carpet bomb the country. But he was able to tell Israel that without Israel think that he's bluffing. One. Second, which is not a little thing, I mentioned last time in 1952, the Israel bonds started, right? So that was a big deal. He threatened, and Israel's now relying a lot on American aid from Jewish American citizens. He said, I'm going to cut off the UJA tax exemptions. All the Jews that are getting charity through the UJA and using it as a tax exemption, no more. You won't get a tax exemption, which would greatly cut down the amount of money that people would donate to Israel. That easily was within his power to do. And Ben-Gurion caved, and Ben-Gurion forfeited all the territory that was gained. All right, what do I want to say?
What does Egypt have, like, in the Sinai Peninsula in particular that's, like, valuable? Like, what's there?
Look, it's a big area that if they're there, they can move their troops onto our border. So we'd rather leave it demilitarized. Okay? Have a huge buffer. But they had troops there. Okay? And in 67, they moved their troops up to our border. But also it was about the shipping, the embargo on our ships. So, okay. At the end of this war, Israel had four Israeli soldiers taken prisoner, including one pilot, Yochanan Alkis. He talked afterwards how he was tortured by the Egyptians. They burnt his lips, his ears, his matches. They did all sorts of crazy things. In order to get the four soldiers back, Israel released the Egyptian soldiers that they captured. Guess the number. 5,850 soldiers to get back the four soldiers.
That's crazy.
Okay.
How old was this?
1956. Now, there were some achievements. Israel's three major achievements were Israel had 11 quiet years on the Egyptian border, 8 with Jordan, 8 more with Lebanon. Now, Fatah, which becomes a PLO, forms and starts causing problems later on, but they at least have some quiet. Right? I remember we were in Boston in 2001-2002. It was during the Intifada. And I met Ravina's relative there. Okay? He had a relative, Reuven Cohn. Reuven Cohn's father had been, I think, the principal of Maimonides. And he himself was a Talmud Chacham. He was an arbiter in, like, judicial cases. It was very interesting. Like, you guys know that I have a great relationship with Rav Bina. But Rav Bina as you know, not everyone loves Rav Bina. And, you know, some people love him, some people hate him. So when I got to Boston, and I said to him, I said, oh, I teach in Nativ Aryeh. He says, before you say anything, I just want you to know, I'm Rabina's cousin. I said, you don't have to warn me. I'm like, I don't have anything bad to say. I love Rabina. He said, okay, I'm just putting it out there. Anyway, he said to me, anyone who's learned Sefer Shoftim, like Josh I know has, he, during the Intifada, it was so bad that he said, I'm not even looking for peace. I'm looking for sheket. It would say in Sefer Shoftim, Vaya Shaket Esrim Shana. You know, it was quiet for 20 years. That's what we had here. Maybe not peace, maybe 11 years of quiet. That's something. I mean, the Navi goes out of its way to say there was 10 years of quiet. There was so this is the first thing. Second, the Tehran Straits were reopened for Israeli shipping with U.S. assurances. And third, Israel's swift action attracted lots of attention from third world countries who now started asking Israel for military aid and military advice. Israel, here's this tiny little country that was amazing. So people looked and said, all right, maybe we can learn from them. And they start exporting. I mentioned this morning that Israel exports fruits all over the world. It's its second biggest export. The first is military, you know, weapons and advice and also technology and stuff like that. That's what Israel's, you know, biggest export is. I mean, drones and all. That's all Israeli done stuff. Like, Israel does all this stuff. Any guys know how the first drone was invented? Okay? This is how Israelis think. There was some wall, I think it was between Egypt and Israel, and anytime someone got close enough to see what was going on over the wall, they would shoot him down. So they had to figure out a way. So one guy sees a kid playing in the park with an electric airplane. You know, he's flying it around. And all of a sudden hits him. He goes, I could put a camera on that airplane. And he took an electric airplane, and he started putting a camera in it, and he told, like, all these sharpshooters, try to shoot it down. But it was so small, they couldn't. You know, it was very hard to shoot it down. It was so tiny. And that's how we got the idea of drones. All right? It was from a kid playing with a plane.
Is really invented a drone? Yes.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So, but one has to be honest and say the biggest victor of this Suez Canal, Mitzvah Kadesh, you know, a Sinai campaign, was Jamal Abdel Nasser. He was able to boast, I rebuffed three, you know, armies, including two world powers. Did he? No. The United Nations stopped them. He didn't do anything. But he said, I came out ahead. So this only led to him later on feeling cocky enough to start again in the Six-Day War. Now, interesting thing. This is a total fiasco, right? Loss of lives, nothing gained, ostensibly. How come there wasn't an outcry by the public? The war in Lebanon, I don't know if any of you guys have heard about this, but that became a fiasco, right? What was gained, and all sorts of people complaining. So how come over there, in Lebanon, there were protests, and here's nothing. So three major differences, maybe four. First one, this was fighting against a nation, Egypt, versus terrorists. When we went into Lebanon, it was to wipe out the terrorist cells in Lebanon, and therefore it wasn't viewed necessarily as a war. Maybe. One. Two. This was a short campaign because of the hasty withdrawal that the United Nations pushed upon Israel, as opposed to Lebanon, which became just a drawn-out thing that every week another soldier was getting killed and people were getting fed up with it. Okay, Rav Bina had sons that were in the war in Lebanon. Okay, I would have been in the war of Lebanon. I mean, it took a long time, but I would have fought in the original war. I'm that age. Right? We thought of making Aliyah. We didn't. When I was later on, you know, in Israel, and I'm looking at all these graves at Har Herzl, so it's like, these are people like my age, right? And I would have been fighting in that war. I'm the age that I would have been fighting in the first Lebanon war. Third, Israeli society changed after the Six-Day War. They felt more secure, didn't feel the need to go in. We're secure, so if some terrorists shoot. And that's a whole other thing I want to point out.
The Six-Day War, is all you
mean? After the Six-Day War. Lebanon is after the Six-Day War, as opposed to this before. Here's the thing that you always have to think about. Let's say I have terrorists that are attacking. Okay? Just this week, there were a couple of things near the old city, right? So you guys all freaked out. I came at today's matter. She goes, did you hear? Did you hear? Okay. So, like, since it's near you, so you, like, freak out. It's not even near you, but whatever. Close enough that you freak out. So now you have a question. What should we do? Let's say, even, here, Baruch Hashem, no one really got killed. But let's say, even, there's a terrorist act and people get killed. Do you now go to an all-out war? On the one hand, you say, yeah, teach them a lesson. On the other hand, realize that if you go to an all-out war, you'll for sure have more deaths from your soldiers as opposed to innocent civilians. I get it. But do I want more Israeli deaths on my conscience? Right? Yes. Let's say an innocent family was killed. In their sleep, people came in and killed them. So now what? Do I go to war and hundreds of soldiers are buried? And how long will the peace last? On the other end, you hold back and there'll just be more attacks and more attacks. So where's the breaking point? I don't have an answer. I'm just saying this is what all the politicians have to deal with. So here we went to war. At this point, you could sit there and say in Lebanon, they felt more secure. There's no need. In 56, people were not as secure and said, we can't let them keep attacking. Okay. And fourth, the media is always leftist. And this war was fought by the left-wing government. This, you know, Ben-Gurion. The war in Lebanon was by the right-wing, crazy Menachem Begin. So, of course, there's something wrong with it. So that's also probably, you know, part of it, if not most of it. I'll just end with one last thing, and that is 1962, America starts becoming an arms supplier for Israel under the, you know, the change of president. Eisenhower's out. Who's the new president that's in?
Except for the actor?
No. Who becomes president in 1960? Oh, you guys are really pathetic. He goes by initials. J.F.
Kennedy.
Oh, J.F. Kennedy, yes. Okay, J.F. Kennedy. So in 1962, Israel receives its first major weapons blessing system.
That's from the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Well, that was early in 60 in Cuba, right. So this is 62. Kennedy agrees to sell Hawk anti-aircraft missiles to Israel. The sale was opposed by the State Department, but Kennedy felt justified after what Nasser escalated the arms race with the Soviet Union, and he decided that he was going to back Israel. Once again, we know that Kennedy got killed in 63, so we don't know. Could have been the beginning of a beautiful relationship. Lyndon Baines Johnson, who took over for him, another LBJ, another initial person, he continued and provided Israel with tanks. This was based on that Israel gave the United States info on Russian tanks that we captured, you know, fighting against Egypt. So this is in America's best interest because of the Cold War going on. So it wasn't just like they decided to like us, but we were supplying them with information that they needed, and now we're getting this. All of this happened because Israel's foreign minister at this time, I mean, she played a pivotal role, was Golda Meir. Golda Meir, who I mentioned this morning, grew up in America. So she was able to speak to them and got Kennedy and then Johnson to start supplying arms to Israel. As I said, up until the Six-Day War, still France was the main supplier. After that, France sort of stops and Israel starts relying more on the United States. All right, we'll stop over here, pick it up from here. That's our time tomorrow.